You're listening to the Innovation in Healthcare podcast, produced by Health Innovation Northeast and North Cumbria, proudly improving health and care for everyone. Secure data environments are a new way for health and care data to be accessed for research and development purposes. It seeks to make access to data safer and easier for researchers and analysts. In this episode, Dr. Alan Bagnall, clinical lead for the Northeast and North Cumbria Secure Data Environment, leads a conversation with Dr. Nihal Hassan, clinical pharmacy lecturer at Newcastle School of Pharmacy, and Arne Volters, head of improvement and analytics for Cumbria, Northumberland, Tyne and Wear NHS Foundation Trust. They discuss how the Secure Data Environment programme will transform how clinical data is accessed, while also ensuring patient privacy.
Hello, my name is Dr. Alan Bagnall, and I'm the clinical lead for the Northeast and North Cumbria Secure Data Environment. Now, many of you are probably wondering, what on earth is a secure data environment? Well, essentially, it's a new way of being able to understand health data and be able to use that health data. So when we look into the past, when we wanted to use health data, we had to go to lots of different organizations and make individual permissions to get data, which they would then share with us. The change that the secure data environment attempts to bring about is to move from this model of sharing the data around to providing one central point of access to that data. And we have a secure data environment now established in the Northeast and North Cumbria, which is our single place of access for researchers in the Northeast, or indeed the rest of the country, who can come to us if they want to have access to data. The key difference here being that we no longer share that data out. So the data remains in one secure place all the time, which is really important for ensuring patient privacy. Now, today I wanted to talk a bit more with researchers who are using the secure data environment about their experiences. So I'm very pleased to invite onto this webcast today two of my colleagues, Nihal Hassan, who is a clinical lecturer in pharmacology at the University of Newcastle, and Arne Volters, who is the head of improvement analytics at one of our large mental health trusts, CNTW, and is also the implementation and knowledge mobilization lead at the NIHR Applied Research Collaborative in the Northeast and North Cumbria. So welcome both of you, and thank you for coming along today to talk about the secure data environment. And Nihal, if I can begin with you. I know you've originally, when we first met, that you were involved in some large projects that were looking at large scale data. Can you tell me a little bit about those projects that you were doing, what you were questions you were hoping to answer with those types of projects?
Well, it's basically about how we can flag up patients who are highly vulnerable to health deterioration due to different determinants of health, different factors, and how we can spot these patients earlier on before getting hospitalized or seeing their GPs so that we can implement clinical interventions early. But to do that, to flag up these patients, we need to learn from previous patients. And this is where the use of data comes from. And this is where the use of SDE is essential for the type of research that we do.
So you were doing the study then, if I've got this right, you were looking at what the factors were in previous patients that predicted whether they were likely to get sick and need extra help.
Exactly. Yeah.
Great. And so what are the types of data points that you're using for a study like that?
So that would be different types of data, really. So what we know from the existing literature, that the more you know about patients, the better you predict their outcome at the end. So for example, if you use the clinical noting data only or the demographic information only about a patient, that might give you an implication whether that patient might deteriorate or not. But if you add to this, for example, their radiographic examination as well, that gives you an additional bit of information. If you add the lab tests that you got for these patients, that's another bit. If you know more about their life, maybe their index of multiple deprivation, their education level, their income level, that might add another extra information to how well you predict their health deterioration. So all these factors we call predictors, and then using different clinical methods and statistical or machine learning methods, we are able to identify the best predictors possible so that we can build predictive tools to predict how people could deteriorate in different outcomes.
And was there a particular clinical area that you were using this for, you know, before surgery to predict who might have problems or?
So there are a couple of projects really that we worked on. So in the past, we have just published a paper about this. So we developed a machine learning based predictive tool that is called SMART. So SMART is a machine learning predictive model that predicts post-operative infections in general elective surgeries in patients before they go to surgery. So that could help the engagement and shared decision making between the patients in the pre-op state, pre-operative stage, preoperative preparation or assessment for the operation, where the surgeon starts to speak to the patient, telling them about the risk of infections after the surgery and how we can reduce that risk of infection after the surgery. So for example, some of the predictors that we had in that SMART model were things like whether you have diabetes, what about if we can control your blood glucose level so your risk would reduce, for example, from a 20% risk to a 10% risk. If we can control your blood pressure, that's how your risk might be modified. If we can treat your anemia before the operation, your risk of infection after the operation could be reduced to that level. So that actually engages the patients to adhere to their treatment plans and also get engaged in the risk estimation after their procedures. So as you can see, it guides a lot that kind of conversations between clinicians and patients and inform the patients more objectively about their risk in terms of procedures or any clinical intervention that we would be doing.
So you're both identifying benefits of doing the operation, what the risks are, and then looking at those things that you can change to lower those risks as much as possible so as to make the procedure as smooth and safe as possible.
Exactly, that's the key thing.
And is that are we at a stage currently where that type of thing is being implemented in our hospitals?
Well, that's really a good question, because we published another paper that talked about the roadmap for clinicians for developing AI predictive models. And in that roadmap, we described 9 stages from starting to think about a research question up to having a tool implemented within an NHS trust. But as you will see in the paper, it passes through a very long process that might take years to implementation. So the first thing you need to think about, like, you have a problem that you address, and then you think about what tool you're going to develop and what methodologies you are going to use to develop that tool. But then you need to validate this tool. So you run the internal validation and external validation. And then you need to test the clinical impact of the tool. Maybe Arnie would talk a lot about that as well. And testing that in a silent clinical environment. And if your tool successfully passes all these steps, then you come to the licensing. In the UK, that's the MHRA, and that might take a couple of years, which is quite a long time to get to. At that stage, when you get a licensed tool, this is where you can put that tool into NHS Trust to use. Maybe in terms of clinical prediction models, at the moment, their implementation in NHS Trusts, because of that very long process of licensing and approval and testing, is not very much as we would hope to see. However, if you look at aspects like radiology, for example, so you will find loads of machine learning tools in radiology have been licensed and implemented, more than tools that are clinical decision support tools in nature.
So I'm certainly seeing that in my practice, that we're beginning to get the first types of artificial intelligence support tools, which, you know, what they do is basically present the information to me in a way that's really easy to digest so that I can make decisions better. And I guess the next stages of that is about developing those tools further so that they give you both really good quality information and provide novel insights for things that, you know, I might commonly miss or that we don't know about yet. For example, if there are specific markers of risk of infection in that patient. And where that helps me as a clinician is to be able to move from the types of information that we get from clinical trials, which talks lots about populations, and then move that down to the personal risk of the person in front of me, you know, their individual characteristics, which affects how they are likely to proceed with the procedure and how well they're likely to benefit from that treatment. Can I bring you in at that point? Am I right in thinking that this type of data is also being used in the mental health trusts that you work in?
Yeah, absolutely. I think the example that Nihal presented is really thinking about sort of a clinical tool and how sort of data informs decisions. I think there's also a wider piece where there's lots of new models of care being rolled out. We're trying to sort of streamline the NHS where patients go, improve access. If you think about government priorities, they're very keen to shift, from illness to prevention, from hospital to community. And a lot of these new models of care sort of might change the way people access services. And as many people will probably know, the NHS consists of lots of different organizations, and the data that I have access to within the trust I work for is sort of limited to that. But some of the changes we're trying to bring about might shift where people sort of go to seek help. So as an example, we're currently evaluating a 24/7 community mental health center that has been opened in Whitehaven, which is in the Lake District, and we're bringing together clinicians from my trust, as well as lots of voluntary care organizations, to support people better, to provide access to mental health services quicker without maybe the need of a referral through a primary care practice. And what we're seeing, it's only been open for a few weeks, but about 40% of patients have not previously been in touch with us as a trust. So for us to understand the impact that a change like that has, we need to be able to look at a wider picture than just the data that we hold, because the result might be that people don't have to go to the GP practice anymore. It might be that people end up in A&E less. And these are all really good outcomes for patients, and probably means they get care in the right place at the right time. But for us to evidence that, we need to be able to bring data together from different NHS organizations to try and understand what is happening with those patients, where are they going instead? Are we sort of achieving that shift? I guess, from a sort of trust leadership perspective, there's also then a conversation around sort of the cost of these interventions and where they go. So we need to develop those insights to really understand how we can deliver on some of these priorities. And to do that, we need to bring the different data sources together.
So that sounds really important for designing services for the region then. So if you're bringing in a new service, you want to be able to understand, not only is it working well, is it providing value for money, but what's its impact on all of those other services? Previously, a lot of the times that data sat in different silos in these different organizations, because, you know, the mental health trusts are separate from the hospital trusts, they're separate from the GPs, they're separate from the local councils who provide many of our other services, they're separate from the voluntary sector organizations. So are you using the SDE then to try and bring all these different types of data together in one place?
I think we're sort of at the edge of being able to do that. And maybe we want to delve in that a little bit more, but I think more and more data is now flowing into the SDE, and it starts to become feasible to look at these questions and sort of try and answer those better. So my trust is flowing data into the SDE. I know some of the acute trusts in the region are as well, and data from primary care starts to trickle in, and a really big third sector care organization is also, I think, in the process of moving their data in. So it's a really sort of exciting time, really, where we can start to bring that data together and look at some of those questions in a bit more detail. Previously, we might have had to rely on national data sets. They don't have anywhere near sort of the same level of granularity within the data. You know, in whatever which way you bring that data together, there's typically very lengthy processes. So as an evaluator in the past, I have evaluated new models of care like this, where we might bring different providers together and link primary and secondary care data together. And realistically, there would be like a 12 to 18 month lead time just to agree sort of the legal basis and get all the permissions in place. And that's even before you can then start flowing the data and bringing it together. So I think there's real value in having an asset like the secure environment, where this data sort of is already safely held in one place and a sort of a clear access route to how you might get to those data and answer those important questions.
Well, let's come on to that, Arne, because I know that you're the chair of what's called the Data Access Committee, sorry, the vice chair of the Data Access Committee for the secure data environment here. Can you talk us a little bit through what the role of this Data Access Committee is, how it assesses the projects, how it assesses the people who are asking to do projects to make sure it's all as safe as possible?
As a Data Access Committee, we take certain checks and balances for granted, because we know they exist and they're looked after elsewhere in the system. So we know the data within the secure data environment are safe. You know, they're sort of in a technically sound environment. What we're there really to think about is whether the projects are being proposed, is whether they are sort of proportionate, whether the amount of information that is being asked for is relevant to the question that is being asked, make sure that we're not sharing too much information for no reason. So we want to sort of, I guess, minimize the amount of data used without putting unwarranted restrictions into place. So if as a researcher you've got a research question, essentially what we would like to know is, what is your research question, how is that relevant to the wider system, and how is it going to realize public benefit, and what data are you going to need in order to answer that question? And really what we're there to do is to enable the use of these data. We just want to make sure it's appropriate use. So you know, if you're trying to understand the impact of a new model of care, so we can learn from that and potentially understand what the benefits are and how we might sort of spread that approach more widely across the region or even across the country, there's a very clear direct benefit to patients, to taxpayers, and we think it's a really good idea to use the data in that way. If you're a private health insurance company and want to improve your algorithms to sort of set your premiums for your customers, that is probably a use where we might not see the public benefit, and the bar would be a lot higher before that is a project that could potentially be approved.
And there's a public evaluations group, I think, that is entirely made out of public members that also look at the projects to assess that very question of, is this in the public interest?
Yeah, that's correct. So the Data Access Committee, I guess, has a slightly more technical lens to its consideration. So it's around the project, the feasibility of delivering it, and the data you need. And we try to support the public evaluation group in understanding what the potential benefit to the health and care system might be if the project was successful. But the decision as to whether the project is deemed in the public interest, that is something that we ask our public members to form an opinion on, rather than sort of the membership of the Data Access Committee itself.
So, Arne, we've now got all of this data beginning to come into the secure data environments. Where do you think are the big directions that this is going to take us? What are the benefits that do we think can come to the region from this? What sort of areas might it be used to develop solutions for?
There'll be a wide range of uses that we would consider. I think we tend to split in our thinking as a Data Access Committee between sort of research projects and what we call the non-research project, which is a bit of a weird term really, but that might be using the data to as an NHS organization better understand the service we are providing. So evaluation might fit within that. Whereas in a typical research project, we're probably talking about academic colleagues who may have sort of been awarded research funding to explore I guess Nihal's example, sort of explore relationships within the data that we didn't know yet that might then sort of help inform clinical decision making. Whereas I think the non-research aspect is more likely to be, understanding the performance of a service, understanding if a new care model has sort of shifted to patient flows, is achieving benefits for patients. I think what's really important though is if you want to maximize the value of this data for all of these uses to happen, and to really think about how we openly sort of share and collaborate our understanding and knowledge. So for somebody who has never looked at the mental health data set before, it's quite a sort of convoluted data set with lots of different relational tables, and if you've not used that previously, it might be difficult to find the right information. So if I've got colleagues from my trust use the data and do carry out some data cleaning steps to make the data sort of more easily usable, like I imagine that we would then free up the syntax or the code that we write in order to clean up the data. So if and the researcher comes in and wants to use mental health data, they can sort of reuse that information and start at the point where the data is sort of more easily interpretable. There's the reduced risk of misuse of the data by accident. And I think we can really create value by having as many people as possible on the platform openly collaborate and sort of exchange that information.
Yeah. So I think, we all kind of share the expertise about our own sort of specialty data with others so that they can use it most effectively.
Yeah, I think like a traditional research project where you use data, if you think about the data that the data analyst spends sort of working on data, I think typically would be like 70% cleaning the data and 30% doing actual statistical analysis. Now, if we work together and we get the experts using their own data on that system and share that knowledge, if we can sort of flip that balance, say, and it becomes 30% cleaning, 70% analysis, we're going to get better at these projects, we're going to get better findings, we're going to be able to move quicker through projects as well, which means we're really creating more and more value for the health and care system as well as sort of patients within our region.
Yeah, and I want to talk a little bit now about some of the other types of research infrastructure that we have in the region. You're part of the Applied Research Collaborative. Is that part of the university, or is that a broader thing? And how might they use data that we have inside the secure data environment for the types of projects that they look at?
Yeah, so I'm part of NIHR's Applied Research Collaboration in the Northeast North Cumbria, and there's nine others across the country, essentially covering most of England. I think what's sort of unique about that is we're a collaboration between academia and healthcare. So we will have colleagues across all six universities in the Northeast and North Cumbria, but we also have sort of clinical partners within the health and care institutions. We have fellows as well, both sort of academic fellows and so what we call practice fellows, working together. And really what we're trying to do, and I guess it's sort of hidden in the name, the Applied Research Collaboration, really thinking about how research can impact day-to-day practice within the health and care system, and how we make sure that the work that Nihal and colleagues do actually leads to changes for patients. And a lot of that has to do with sort of evaluating new models of care or supporting innovations collecting the evidence on how effective they are, but also on why they are effective. So in addition to using the data, there might be sort of some qualitative interviews and talking to patients and really understanding if we want to introduce this particular algorithm, what are the things we need to have in place in order to get there? What are the enablers to allow that sort of innovation to be implemented elsewhere as well, and make sure that we learn from implementation in different places.
So it sounds like data is fundamental to all of those things. So I'm assuming that for this next round of funding for the research collaborative, having that data now available from the Northeast is going to really help supercharge these types of projects.
Yeah, absolutely. I envisage a number of our research themes and projects to be using the secure data environment. And really important factor for us will be like the adoption and spread of innovation. So if we know something works, for instance, in Cornwall, and we want to try it out in Northeast Northumbria, obviously we want to try and adopt that research and make sure we reap the benefit of innovation down south. But we also want to monitor that innovation actually delivers, and I think that's where the data really comes in to help us understand how we might adopt or even adapt innovations developed elsewhere to benefit people within our health and care system as well.
Nihal, as a researcher doing this type of big data research, what do you think the benefits that you'll see from the secure data environment compared to how, for example, when you were doing this type of work a few years ago?
Well, I think a couple of things, really. So the first thing for me would be the data privacy and confidentiality that we discussed earlier. The second thing would be linking data sets. So let's say, for example, if you need to link data sets from different healthcare settings, if you want to get information about primary care linked to secondary care, how you're going to do that without an SDE, it's almost impossible. So I think that's a big thing when you think about tracking the patient journey across different care settings, which would be very helpful. The third thing is really when you try to understand relationships between health and non-health data as well. So for example, if you want to understand the effect of any publicly available information on the health outcomes of patients. So let's say, for example, if you want to predict risk of hospitalization of mental health patients in relation to green spaces in their residential area in people with multiple mental health conditions. So let's say depression and anxiety, for example. So to do that, you need data from CNTW, for example. You need data about green spaces, which is a non-health data, and you need them to be linked together. The only way to do that is to put it into an SDE. You can't actually do that outside. So I think the use of SDE allows us to answer more research questions, which could imply on better healthcare provided to people, especially if we want to support the initiative of the NHS and the NHS transformation plan of moving from a diagnosis and treatment model of care to a prevention and prediction model of care. So I think the only way forward through that is to put that information into the SDE to address these research questions.
Yeah, I guess we've always... You know, as a patient, you assume that the data that you tell a doctor or a nurse in one place is available to doctors and nurses in other places. But actually, the link up between different systems isn't really there as much as we would like.
And yeah, I think the key thing here is systems do not talk to each other. So SDE maybe try to find that kind of link for conversation between different systems together.
Yeah, absolutely. And presumably when systems can start talking to one another, as you've exemplified, Arne, you can then start working out how systems can work, you know, rather than just individual projects. It's all about how do these things join up and work together as a system. But you can also, I guess, look at safety aspects as well. So there might even be ways that, you know, when healthcare isn't as good as we hope, that we can use that to investigate all the different aspects that impact on that, that with data that might be coming from, as you say, environmental data, for example, or from hospital data, from primary care data, and being able to see the whole picture can be really helpful in trying to understand when things go wrong. So I think that's given us a really great overview of the type of work that we're doing within the secure data environments. And I'd be remiss if I didn't say that there are other secure data environments around the country. There are 11 currently. And the next big step is about those secure data environments being able to talk to one another so that we can now develop the insights that we've spoken about here from the regions and being able to compare between regions and potentially look at national projects as well. Arne, can you tell us a little bit about the new health data research service that's going to try and bring together a lot of the data that sits in these secure data environments currently?
Then, yeah, I wouldn't call myself an expert on this, but I'll talk to the best of my understanding. I think really what we're trying to achieve is sort of a single front door and sort of a common way of accessing these data across the country. And I think delivering some interoperability between secure environments will be really important as well. And I've talked about sort of adoption and spread of innovation. If you think about the process to, I think Niall mentions, if you want to get a new innovation sort of certified to be used across the board, you want to obviously, you know, test it in different settings as well. And in order to do that, you're typically looking at sort of different settings that are geographically spread as well, with like slightly different population compositions and things like that. So imagine you're running a research program where you want to test something in the Northeast, in Cambridgeshire and in Somerset, for instance. If you want to be able to understand the impact that a new innovation or a new tool might have, and you'd have to talk to three different systems, get three sets of data linked together, to then do different sort of three distinct pieces of analysis because the data might look different as well. You know, that adds a lot of layers of complexity. If there is a single front door and there's collaboration of the secure environments sort of behind that front door that we might not be you might not be aware of as a user, but it allows you to essentially relatively quickly compare your findings in three different areas without having to reinvent the wheel and go through three sets of permissions, you're in a position where we can really sort of move forward in adoption and spread and really support how research is adopted into practice.
Exactly. I mean, I think you touched on one of the key themes there, isn't it? Is that how do you give researchers access to data safely, securely, but do that in a way that's quicker than we had in the past? Because as you said, in the past, you'd have to reach out to all of these different contacts individually. That can take months or years to get together. If you could have a single system, all using the same criteria, the same processes, and just come through one single pathway to get your approvals for the entire region or the entire country even, then you've got the ability to put your research in progress more quickly, and then develop your answers and get those answers implemented a lot more quickly.
Yeah, so I think a good example of that at the moment already of sort of that collaboration is we've had a conversation within our data access committee how we would treat a project application that maybe is led by a university in the northwest of England, and they would like to use data from both secure environments. So rather than having to go through another set of permissions, essentially we're creating a route where, as a data access committee, we can say, right, this has been scrutinized and tested in the northwest already. You know, they've met the criteria. The data access committee there is happy for this to proceed. Therefore, we will essentially carry that recommendation forward, and we won't ask the researchers to go through the same process again because they also want to use some information in the northeast. And I think it's those types of collaborations that we want to see at a national scale, and that's where the HSDR will come in and hopefully deliver that.
Well, that's great. I want to thank you both today. It's been a fascinating discussion that we've had about this, about the challenges there is about bringing data together from lots of different sources in order to be able to develop these new insights, to develop research or to design services, and to talk about how you're using the secure data environment to make that a reality. So thank you very much.
You have been listening to the Innovation in Healthcare podcast, produced by Health Innovation Northeast and North Cumbria. If you'd like to find out more about secure data environments, you can visit our website at healthinnovationnenc.org.uk/podcasts, where you can find further resources in this podcast show notes. Thank you for listening.